I'm gonna give this talk basically structured around a previous talk that I gave, but there's gonna be, it's basically, I've taken out the easy bits. Because this audience is so sophisticated that I wouldn't want to leave them unconfused. There are a large number of collaborators, some of whom will come up in other view graphs as well, but especially important to me are her book and Stephen Hayden and there's various other people who are making samples. Let me just start off this view graph. I know is obsolete at this point, but I just want to remind you that, you know, sort of things we know about the magnetism that we're pretty sure of. One is that it's basically two-dimensional. The other thing we know about is the phase diagram, which describes how magnetism goes away. Of course, you know that, of course, very early on we discovered that there was the simple Heisenberg-type spin-a-half anti-ferromagnetism of the square lattice, which dominated in this portion of the phase diagrams. More recently, people have gotten very interested in sort of longer period magnetic structures, which seem to be lurking around the optimal superconducting composition for the
why
in this case would be, in the case of latham copper oxide, would be substitution of neodymium, which creates chemical pressure. This is at this point, it was always only a schematic phase diagram, which is now being filled in by various people other than myself. This was originally, when we drew this, it was known that there was one neodymium composition for which you could get rather clean spin density wave, charge density wave combination, not far away from the optimal superconductors, which of course have no neodymium in them. The point is that magnetism is lurking around everywhere, not just over here, but actually also in that area. The other belief about the magnetism, which I'm going to challenge a bit, is that the Heisenberg model with strong nearest neighbor exchanges is the basis for all of the magnetism over here. And the first of the part of the talk, I'm going to describe why I believe that not to be the case. In fact, that there are important other terms in that Hamiltonian, and I'm going to compare it with an insulating system where such terms are not present.
What's that red line?
The red line is historical. That happened to be the only high TC sample that we had for about 8 years, and somebody wanted to give to us. But it's basically just when you do the story basically that went with this view graph. I'm sorry. Panda bears eat bamboo bits. It must be panda bear around. The point is that, you know, when you have a typical sample in this phase diagram, especially even a superconducting sample, that as you cool down, you tend to see different pieces of this landscape, and the piece that you see at the highest temperatures and the highest energies is, you know, generally will tend to be the antiferromagnetic piece, and as you cool down, you tend to be more sensitive to these other things going on, such as the onset of the stripe phases. And that's just what that red line is for. That's just to tell you that your ability to see the ability to see things changes as you change energy and change temperature, and you're dominated by different pieces. Sorry. Trust me with this. Okay, great. So let me just say, this is one picture, that sort of paradigm that people have been taking, and this is why what I'm going to try to do is challenge maybe the first line of this paradigm, is the typical TJ type way of looking at the high TC problem is to start, you know, just to say, well, you start with the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and then you throw in that basic form of the J-code model.
Wrong color! I'm sorry.
Four sticks.
You've got the sublime, the ridiculous, and the absurd here.
What are these sticks? How many more did you have? Do you have a laser pointer?
Never say die. I do have one of those.
Like, could you bring me a laser pointer?
I won't come back and entertain you.
Maybe you could bring me a shrubbery or whatever they did. That's a Monty Python thing. The Knights of Me or something. I don't know. Okay. This is sort of how people, one sort of way that people think about the relationship between the magnetism and the superconductors. They start with the antifermionic Heisenberg Hamiltonian, then they say, well, you know, you put carriers in and it becomes a spin fluid, and then there's some kind of quantum critical point between the antifermionic and spin fluid phases. And then you say, well, that doesn't quite account for everything because, of course, it's conventional spin fluid in an insulator is sharply gapped, and these systems are not sharply gapped, so you throw in some damping to take account of metallicity. And then you wave some arms some more to get an accounting of other ground states that are nearby, for example, these stripe phases. So this is sort of, I think, the standard sequence. And what I'm going to try to tell you is that really the starting point actually may be, at least the first part of the talk, the starting point may actually be flawed. And so to look at this, as I'm going to ask you, this sort of Heisenberg thing with quadratic exchange interactions, all we need to understand the spin sector of the high TC problem. And there are going to be basically two parts of the talk. Actually, there's going to be a third part of the talk, which will deal with incommensurabilities, which will try to convince you that there are other ways you can get incommensurabilities than the stripe phases that you know and love. But the first part of the talk is I'm going to just revisit the insulator. And then I'm going to look at actually excitations in the superconductor particularly in the Y123 superconductor to show you that perhaps some, you know, that there are a simple spin model, simple quadratic spin model, is probably not adequate. So let's start with the insulator. So the insulator we all know and love is this La2CO4. It has this extremely well-known thing that I don't need to go, well-known Bessel planes, which I don't really need to repeat. People, of course, generally think, well, that, you know, because there's a typically, of course, hopping through the oxygens between nearest neighbor coppers, there can also be hopping involving further neighbor coppers. And as a result of all that, you might expect not only to get a strong nearest neighbor exchange interaction, but also non-negligible further neighbor exchange interactions. And when we started these experiments, we were just going to go and measure those. Historically, we have been unable to measure those for reasons that I'm going to show you in the next view graph. Let me just show you that we have, even though we're experimentalists, we can look at formulas and books just as well as theorists can. And this is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which we did not need to look up because we remember that. But then it turns out, of course, that the spin wave energies are related to these parameters. And in a rather simple language, the spin wave energies are simply related to the Fourier transform in space of the the pattern of exchange interactions that you have. And then for good measure, you typically throw in some kind of a quantum renormalization factor, which one believes, at least at long wavelengths in the 2D Heisenberg model, could be something like 1.18. So those are spin waves. Now, let me describe to you why we don't know very much until now, have not known very much about these further neighbor interactions. This actually shows you the spin wave dispersion surface calculated for that model in two cases. One is where there is there are no other interactions apart from the first neighbor Heisenberg exchanges. In this case here, where there are. And what you'll notice immediately is two things. The first thing you'll notice is that these things are remarkably similar, especially if you can't measure the zone boundary. But there is one, and they're remarkably similar in that there's this conical branch of spin waves emerging from the magnetic zone centers. The colors here refer to the amplitudes of the spin waves. And of course, they vanish at these magnetic zone centers, which happen to coincide with the nuclear zone centers, but they get very strong at the New Bragg peaks that are introduced by the antiferromagnetism. So the end point is, of course, the famous, which we call pipe pi, or half the half. What's interesting is that when these two numbers are zeros, there's a symmetry in the problem which says that the spin wave energies are actually independent of Q along the zone boundary, and that, in essence, the system is somehow one-dimensional, if you like, at the zone boundary. However, if you put in even quite modest J prime and J double prime, there is a wrinkle that shows up. Now, it's very clear now is why we haven't really been measuring these things before, is that in the old days, these energies in the high TC materials are high. The exchanges, the nearest neighbor exchange is something like 0.16. You double that, you get 3/10 of a volt, between 3 and 4/10 of a volt for the zone boundary energy. And that then means, but at the zone boundary, these are very big energies, and we've basically had been running with very large detectors at very high energies, which meant that the neutron momenta were also high. And so with those high momenta, we were not resolving features of the zone boundary. In fact, we were just taking essentially integrals over the zone boundary. So we're really basically seeing a density of states at the zone boundary rather than a detailed Q dependence of the spins wave energies at the zone boundary. And so having re-equipped our instrument with position sensitive detectors, we revisited this issue. So now we're doing high momentum resolution and relatively high energy resolution, neutron scattering up at 3/10 of a volt to figure out, you know, what the geography is at the zone boundary. And these are just the scans that we got. And this actually shows you just a set of points, set of different Q vectors along the zone boundary. And what you see now very clearly is, yes, indeed, there is a dispersion. And you're seeing here that if you go to this three-quarter, one-quarter point as opposed to this point here, you're discovering that this energy here is well below, is clearly below 300 millivolts, whereas this energy up here is clearly above. What you're also seeing here, these are low-temperature data, what you're seeing here is that these peaks are still very sharp and nicely resolution limited.
Even in the neighbor model, aren't there corrections, high order
models? I'm going to discuss that, yeah. There are corrections. So in any case, you can now go ahead and basically replot. I'm not dwelling very long on this because I think many of you have seen these data before. I think the only thing you haven't seen is the data that addresses the point that Sabir raised. What you find is a spin wave dispersion, which basically you can you can start here again at the half point, then you have this wonderful cone, and then you see actually along the zone boundary here between a half zero and 3/4 and 1/4, where you should have seen a dispersionless branch. The branch actually has a lot of dispersion. It's something like 30 millivolts. So 30 millivolts is actually pretty seems like a small number compared to 300 millivolts, but is a large number compared to 100 Kelvin or 10 millivolts. So there's a substantial dispersion. So what do you make of this? Well, if you go into, I just use this Hamiltonian that I wrote down, just with the quadratic terms in it. You then reach, of course, as always in these things, there's actually, if you only had the first two of these terms, of course, it would be unambiguous for J prime, what J prime really would be. But the point is, if this second term here, you would expect to be present as well. And so the best you can do as an outcome of this experiment is actually to show an error ellipse, which contains the most likely pairs of values of J double prime and J prime. And what's very interesting here with this ellipse is again, actually, you know, telling you that these numbers here can be of order 10 millivolts. Okay, this J prime can be of order 10 millivolts. J double prime will be a bit smaller. But what's especially interesting is the sign of J prime that's required by the data. In fact, the sign that's required by the data is generically negative, which means that the second neighbor interaction is actually ferromagnetic. That means there's the same sublattice for the antiferromagnet. The second neighbor interaction, in some sense, actually would actually like to stabilize the antiferromagnetism that's promoted by the first neighbor interaction. So what we seem to be getting within this silly, rather naive analysis, which doesn't take account of quantum corrections, which we'll discuss in a minute, is a ferromagnetic next nearest coupling. Well, this is not expected. And of course, there are a variety of things that come to mind that might produce this. And one immediate question is, perhaps are we really using the wrong Hamiltonian when we're analyzing the data? In fact, when I'm saying that this sign of coupling is not expected, I'm saying that based on cluster calculations, which people did in the late 80s, early 90s, when they were starting to diagonalize, you know, small pieces of copper oxides. And whenever they tried to back out at the end of the day what these further neighbor couplings would be, they were typically antiferromagnetic, they were not ferromagnetic. And so this was not really expected. The other thing that I'll show you in a few minutes, because we have new data on this subject, is you might say, well, is this actually what you get if you insisted to fit the outcome of a proper quantum mechanical solution for the spin waves with the classical solution? In fact, there also you would expect that the effective consequence of quantum fluctuations is actually to have an anti-ferromagnetic next nearest neighbor coupling, second neighbor coupling, rather than the ferromagnetic coupling. And so that is why I say it's not expected. Second question, so one possibility is that we could in fact be using the wrong Hamiltonian. And in fact, in these same cluster calculations that talked about further neighbor interactions of the conventional variety, those cluster calculations actually got very, very substantial ring exchange terms, which involve four spins rather than two spins. And in fact, we can reanalyze the data using the ring exchange, and I'll show you in detail what Hamiltonian we actually used to put in the ring exchange. And you in fact discover that you can, not surprisingly, if you linearize things, that, you know, having a ring exchange term is there, is actually turns out to be equivalent to having a quadratic term with a ferromagnetic second neighbor interaction, just when you do the algebra and linearize the whole business. And so if you do linear spin wave theory assuming a ring exchange term, of course you can also fit the data, and that's in fact the fit that we get. Now, let's have...
Is that complicated by the fact that if you use a projection, full ring exchange P1234 plus the inverse, and you did what you just said, it wouldn't give you any effect, or am I misremembering something?
If the ring exchange gives you, the thing is, you cannot tell. If I show you a linear spin wave thing, like if I show you a bunch of spin waves which are resolution limited as these are, you cannot tell whether that is coming from ring exchange or some complicated quadratic Hamiltonian. The only thing you can tell at the end is whether the parameters that you are getting are making sense when you use either ring exchange or quadratic term. Okay, and so what I'm actually arguing, and the reason actually it took us a while to realize that the ring exchange made more sense, was precisely that, because from the neutron experiment itself, there is no way to tell which interpretation is correct. You have to know something else about the problem, and at the end, that something else is actually what's contained in this.
I'm lost. Which of the two interpretations is there competing here?
Excuse me?
What are the two interpretations you're talking about?
There are two interpretations, right? One interpretation is, if I show you a bunch of spin waves for some system, but I show you a Hamiltonian like that, which is, you know, in fact where we use it, I already told you that there's actually substantial ambiguity about, you know, there's a trade-off between these two things and this thing here. In addition, of course, these things trade off against that. And all I can tell you is if I block out various pieces of this thing, whether I can get a plausible fit to the data using the other parameter. I'm telling you that I could actually turn off the ring exchange term as I did before and get a fifth of the data, however, the second neighbor interaction will wind up having a sign which is inconsistent with something else that I know about the problem. Okay?
This is true for all points in the Brillouin zone? And you went through this triangle. Could you go to other
points? That is, yeah, basically what happens as you go lower in the zone is you just tend to get combinations of things that then it's even more ambiguous. You see, going to the Brillouin zone is where you bring out these terms most clearly. If you go in, and actually I'll show you some data in a minute which will show clearly how the geometry works, is you want to go out where the contours of equal energy turn out to be squares rather than circles, or things which are not just simple circles. Once you get into the region of the low enough energies where the equal energy contours are circles, and there's no information, basically. Okay. So what we're doing is we're going to the zone boundary to maximize the information, and then even there's ambiguities. The only way to resolve those ambiguities is, in fact, to appeal to other considerations. And this is the thing that actually this view graph appeals to. The point is that now we're just going to say we have a model with all of these terms in it, but let's for the moment neglect these two things which I talked about a minute ago. And let's just ask how big is the ring, would the ring exchange term have to be to account for the dispersion that we've actually found along the zone boundary. And so if you fit this, then actually you get a very substantial ring exchange term, which is something like almost 50 millivolts, which is again not surprising because I told you before the dispersion was 30 millivolts. You get a first neighbor interaction, which is 140 millivolts. And now it turns out actually that this number, these two numbers, are pretty much what you get from the old cluster calculations. But what's even, at least we found even more fascinating or amusing, was that these numbers are also the numbers that appear when you do, I guess, what Steve and Alan McDonald did 10 years ago, namely look at a Hubbard Hamiltonian, which, as you know, is also a thing, at least for an experimentalist, is some thing that everybody knows and loves, with two unknowns in it, namely a Coulomb potential and a Hopping matrix element. And what Gerber, McDonald, and so who else?
Yoshioka.
Okay, his friend Yoshioka did was they gave us in a series of errata a set of correct expressions for. I wasn't going to let you get away without saying it was achieved by iteration. They achieved the truth by iteration. And the truth was that they got an expression for J in terms of these things and then the ring exchange. And then they also got us what these things were. And what's interesting is that now, of course, we have two equations and two unknowns. So we can actually just take the neutron data, which is a charged neutral probe, and simply solve for U and T. And interestingly enough, if we just take neutron spin wave data, it's a charged neutral probe, and then we ask, well, what is the T that what's the Hopping matrix element that we would get out? Now we're just fitting the full Monty, so to speak. We actually get 0.32 electron volts for the Hopping matrix element and a U of 2.6 plus or minus 0.3 EV. And what's interesting about the expansion also is that actually the ring exchange term is much more substantial than these further neighbor interactions. These are actually down by a factor of 20. They're both of order t to the fourth over u cubed, but this is a factor of 20 down from that. And so what's rather shocking is actually at the end of the day, from this charge neutral, relatively low energy probe, you're actually getting the same numbers for the Hubbard model that parameterize the Hubbard model for this La2CO4 as you get from electron spectroscopies, which are, you know, much cruder probes, you know, the basically X-ray absorption measurements that were done early on and various estimates that we have the bandwidth. So the real statement, I guess, based on our experiments is that there's a simple model that fits our data and a complicated model that fits our data. The complicated model is something with a lot of further neighbor exchange interactions. The simple model is just the Heisenberg model. That's a complicated model in this case. Or the simple model could actually, that actually really describes the data, could just as well be said to be the Hubbard model. And the Hubbard model actually accounts for the wrinkle that we see in the, and the sign, and the sign of the wrinkle in the, in the, in the spin wave dispersion along its own boundary.
Question. Usually, if you look at the Fermi surface of the cuprates, you ought to have a T prime, which then will also give rise to the renormalization of J prime
prime. There might actually, yeah, sure. There will also be such terms, and I'll wait for Steve and his friends to produce a series of papers which will tell us how to calculate those. What's remarkable is we only need these two parameters now to describe what we have. And these are the parameters that a lot of people here have been using when they say that the Hubbard model is a starting point. The point, the important point is that you see U is actually, you know, not infinite. And that if you relax that condition, then in fact a lot of, you know, these things drop out. Okay. So other things we can do, we can check, and I'm gonna in a moment take U to infinity because I have a system where we can take it to infinity. Or it is at infinity, we can, of course, not only just look at spin wave dispersions, we can also look at spin wave amplitudes to see just how accurate the spin wave theory is. And these amplitudes here are in absolute units. They're measured in absolute units. They're also calculated in absolute units using, the using again, this expansion for the, using the cyclic term in the Hamiltonian. Now, there's actually one other piece of circumstantial evidence which favors the cyclic interpretation. In fact, in ladder compounds, I don't have a view graph devoted to this because I haven't worked in the ladder compounds myself, but it turns out that in the ladder compounds, you will discover that there's, of course, two, there's a wrong term, and there's a term that's parallel to the axis of the ladder. And those, if you, and of course, the cyclic term is present also in the ladder. And if you choose to ignore the cyclic term in the ladder, in fact, you get wildly anisotropic J's along the rungs and parallel to the ladder. However, if you put a cyclic term of 50 millivolts in, as we have here measured, you actually find then that the J's are isotropic in the ladder. In other words, the J, the rung term and the term along the ladder actually become, can be the same. And so having a cyclic, and again, those are, the building blocks are the same. You're again simply finding, I think, something which you knew from the cluster calculations is that there's a large, that, that things become much easier to understand if you have a large, if you have a large cyclic term rather than some elaborate further neighbor exchange terms. Now, spin wave, now of course this is just showing you how well spin wave theory works. You can linearize everything nicely and it works in absolute units. Actually, extraordinarily well. So even after you take account of this cyclic term. So now a question arises, which Subir asked earlier, which is how do you know that this isn't these aren't quantum corrections to the simple spin a half Heisenberg model? Of course, there are two ways to check that. One is just simply to say they are not, because I know from Rajiv Singh that they are not because the sign is different. The other way is actually to do an experiment on an organic anti-ferromagnet where the U-term is actually much larger. In other words, the effective the ratio of T to U is much smaller, and so that you're dealing with a system where the charge fluctuations are essentially completely suppressed. And this is a famous two-dimensional. We decided then to check whether the various series expansions that people had made to figure out whether there was a zone boundary dispersion for the simple nearest neighbor coupled quantum antiferromagnet, we decided to check that on an organic copper-based antiferromagnet, copper formate tetrabutyrate, which is basically a square planar array of copper atoms, where the exchange now proceeds, you know, through some complicated pathways involving water and God knows what. I'm not going to show you what the molecule looks like. I'm just going to tell you it is really a realization of a real Heisenberg model where the charge fluctuations are very much suppressed. This stuff, if you want, all you really need to know about this stuff
which contrasts with the cuprates is it's transparent. Cuprates, of course, even the undoped ones are black to the naked eye. So we went ahead and we've done a large number of measurements, some of which actually we just completed last week on this system. This actually shows you some samples of the raw data that we've taken in the past. This shows you basically the spin waves. Now, the zone boundary magnon energy in this stuff is much lower. It's something like 16 millivolts, which is a factor of course, 20 below what you get for the cuprates. And what you see here is simply the raw data taking along a major symmetry direction. This is just the in-plane momentum transfer. This is the energy transfer. And you see here this nice spin wave cone, which we're crossing here, produce this nice spin wave profiles, and then going out towards the zone boundary, bending over. And here you see a rather nice peak out at the zone boundary being crossed now as a function of energy. And we've done a lot of physics in this system for the first time, which I won't have any time to discuss today, but I'd love to talk to you privately if you have questions. What we've done here is we've actually done looked in detail at the effects of warming on the damping of these spin waves and find basically that some glorified Chakravarti, Halpern, Nelson theory describes those things rather well. Let me now show you some brand new images of the spin waves in this material. And what I'm doing here is we're actually cutting the, we're fixing the energy transfer, the frequency, and we're just simply looking at these contours of equal energy in the two-dimensional reciprocal space for the CFTH. And what you see here already at this energy, which is not so far from the zone boundary energy, let's see if I, is that you see these circular objects, which are actually already becoming somewhat squarish. Okay, as you go up to the, this is now between 11 and 13 millivolts. And if you go up to the zone boundary energy, or close to the zone boundary energy, then actually you get these rather square-looking objects, actually with some modulation of intensity, actually along the zone boundary. And in fact, if you then take a lot of data like these, you can then again plot up the dispersion curve for this CFTD at 8 Kelvin. And what you can do is you basically go along the same direction that we went for the La2CO4. And what you find is that there is actually a difference in zone boundary energies, again, between the pi 0 zone boundary point and the pi over 2 zone boundary point. However, in this case, this pi 0 point has actually a lower energy than the pi over 2 point. And you see that the solid line here is actually what you have for the simple next nearest neighbor interaction, Heisenberg-Hamiltonian. And this dashed line
within
spin wave theory. And this is just linear spin wave theory with no quantum correction. This dashed line is actually taking account of quantum corrections using Rajiv's series expansion. And you find that actually the data are rather close to what the series expansion actually tells you it should be. I've lined these two things up so that they correspond precisely to each other. And what you see is that the pure LA2CO4 really does have an effect of opposite sign. What you see here is that the energy at the pi over 2 point is lower, and in fact this energy goes higher over at pi 0. So the sign is different, and so you could actually even say that here the suppression relative to the naive classical model of the zone boundary magnon is something like 10% or 15%, and here the enhancement the other way around is 10 or 15%. And so our belief is that we really do have a different physics which is defining the issues in the LA2CO4, then you have either in the theory for the spin a half Heisenberg model with quantum fluctuations, or in fact in this experimental realization of that.
So, question: I mean, Rajiv's calculations for just the nearest neighbor model, how much lower is it?
That's the dashed line.
That is the dashed line. So does that mean that?
So basically, this is the result of an expansion from the Ising limit, basically using a J of 6.31, which is basic from Rajiv's.
So does that mean that the ring exchange term is probably bigger than the estimate you get?
You said it first.
Oh.
Yep. That's what I'm saying. This is a 10% effect this way, and the 10%. But the ring exchange term may be 60 millivolts instead of 50. But the point is, it's within, you know, what you would think, basically, you would get for some kind of a reasonable Hubbard model description of the planes. So, the whole upshot of this is, I think that if you think you're going to do your physics just with TJ, you should think again, because there are 50 millivolt ring exchange terms floating around, which, you know, may do all kinds of interesting stuff that you know might not expect just if you had ordinary exchange. I think that's really.
Is it? Stabilize RVD.
You said that first too. Yeah. The ring exchange has opposites. When you do the laundry, it the outcome for the ring exchange for the zone boundary magnon has opposite sign.
But the coupling itself has the same sign.
The coupling is the same sign. Yeah. It's just 50 millivolts. Okay, so So I think basically this does two things. Right? One, it legitimizes saying you really ought to start with the Hubbard model, and the second thing it does is that that one interesting thing about the Hubbard model, which is not shared by the TJ model, are these ring exchange terms, which are fascinating because they also are things that couple to orbital currents, well, for obvious reasons, in more obvious ways than, let's say, the ordinary exchange terms do. So there's a range of phenomena that open up. There's also, once you have these ring exchange terms, it's much easier to understand some of the funny line shapes that people saw early on in Raman scattering. The Raman scattering was really never properly understood using a simple Heisenberg exchange, but it looks like it is understandable again if you put ring exchange terms of this order. In fact, a lot of the work on the small clusters was motivated by the desire to explain the anomalous Raman line shapes.
In the second calculation that you showed, with Rajiv Singh's series example, there was no ring exchange there, right?
No, that's the whole point. You see, there was none in the theory, and in that organic crystal, there was none either because it's transparent. And so U is, you know, much larger. And so I selected a system where I can, by optical investigation, holding the crystal up against the light, I can tell that U is going to be bigger. And so those higher order terms don't matter as much. So conclusions are, you know, maybe we ought to think about where we're starting from. They're substantial on the scale of TC further neighbor interactions. Ring exchange term, I think, is a term to worry about. These data, as well as the data on the ladders, are much easier to understand if you put ring exchange terms in, which are, you know, of order 30% of the ordinary exchange terms. These ring exchange terms are remarkably consistent with the Hubbard model calculations of Steve and his friends, and especially if we use the parameters from electronic spectroscopies. It's sort of amusing that we've now taken the charge neutral low energy probe, which gives to actually get independent estimates of effective electronic parameters TADU, which are in rather good agreement. And even when all of this is said and done, of course, for this particular system, the spin wave theory does give an excellent account of the absolute amplitudes as well as the dispersion. And last but not least, we have now looked at a different system which looks to be a more ideal Heisenberg model with a, if you like, a bigger U or infinite U. And there, the theory with quantum corrections gives an excellent account of the dispersion at the zone boundary, which we've been able to identify. Okay, how much more time do you want to listen to?
Come on, dope this other material.
It's horrendous. Yeah, it's just an organometallic compound which we believe will be rather hard to do. It's also got a very small J, which is not good for.
What's the name of the compound? You say C.
Upper formate tetrahydrate. Yeah. It's a layered hydrogen bonded material. So, I've sort of told you a lot about La2CO4. Now, Y123, of course, is always a more desirable thing to work with because it's got a higher TC. It's supposed to be cleaner. It's easier to adjust stoichiometry. There's certainly a lot more data of other types around. And unfortunately, here we have not actually yet looked at the spin waves in the kind of detail that. We looked at in the case of the La2CO4, and actually the last time we looked at this material was in 1996, when we just simply measured a rather crude dispersion curve, which showed an optic and acoustic mode, throughout the zone for the oxygen 6.15 parent compound. What's interesting is that the zone boundary energy seems to be substantially lower than it is in the La2CO4. And so you can't always assume, I think the main lesson from this is you can't always assume that it's going to be, as high as 3/10 of a volt in all of these materials. Of course, because it's a bilayer, you get optic and acoustic mode splittings, and one other surprise in all this was actually that the optic mode splitting was rather large. Now, if we also looked at the intensities of the spin waves, they agreed with the classical model, both for the optic and acoustic branches. And to look for potential terms, ring exchange terms, or orbital type terms, we really have to. We've really been doing other things in the Y123 than revisit the spin waves. Although I think we will do that soon. And of course, what you'll remember about the Y123 is that when you start to dope it, its spectrum is a lot more complicated than that of the 214. And those spectra are just showing you here for a case by case 63 Kelvin superconductor. And there are a few features in these spectra that you were probably familiar with, and others you're less familiar with. Of course, the main thing that everybody has been very excited about is this resonance. Resonance, of course, does ride on a background like that, which on warming, actually initially this background contains this famous pseudogap. Of course, on warming, that pseudogap disappears. You get a very nice linear response up at room temperature, linear as a function of
frequency.
This is Q integrated. These are simply the dead Caesar states. And you have, interestingly enough, actually in the optic channel, which is basically out of phase motion of the spins, you find a rather more boring spectrum. But there is one curiosity about this, about the optic mode. And that's that it is actually still very, very sharply defined, even up at 80K, probably even up at around room temperature. And actually, one of the mysteries is why the optic modes not decay more rapidly in the metal. This is just an aside. This is something that's been bothering us for a while. Now, so the upshot is the Y123, when you dope, there's a lot more stuff. There's an optic mode. There's a spin gap in the superconducting phase. There's a pseudogap normal phase. it's this onset temperature T star, and then there's also this famous resonance. And how in the world are we going to say anything about the underlying spin Hamiltonian when things are so complicated, especially now in the superconducting phase? And so in the first experiment in the LA2CO4, we address the underlying sort of features of the spin Hamiltonian by looking at the simplest case, which is the pure insulator, and starting to fit the data and try to understand what quantitatively what was going on. Now, when we take Y123 and we've doped it, there's no way we can test any quantitative theories of what's going on to say whether somehow the TJ approach is the correct approach. However, there is one thing that we can do to see whether the TJ approach really has all of the right physics here. And that is, we can try to apply a magnetic field to the material. And since we have this very sharp resonance, if somehow the spin Hamiltonian were the only thing relevant for producing the sharp resonance, then we expect, of course, that the main effect of the field would just be traceable to the Zeeman effect. On the other hand, if there's something more elaborate going on, such as some kind of coupling to orbital currents or what have you, you might actually start to see non-Zeeman type effects you might actually be able to see non-Zeeman type effects on the resonance itself. And so what we did was, let me make the logic here a bit clearer. If I have a system with a spin gap, a conventional system with a spin gap, or a conventional system with some resonance in it somewhere due to some underlying magnetic, sort of quadratic magnetic Hamiltonian, then such a situation would be, for instance, in the spin-pile's case, I put a field on and I just simply split the excitation, let's say, three ways, because the lowest lying excited state would be a triplet. I would split it three ways, and that would be the end of it. And in fact, all of the physics that comes about in the Haldane problems in the field, or in the spin-pile's problems in the field, can basically just be traced to some splitting of some triplet. And of course, the field then simply has to compete with the size of the field has to have an interesting effect, has at the very least to be large compared to the width of the excitation to begin with, and to be really interesting, you'd like the field to be comparable, GmbH to be comparable to the energy gap. If there's something more subtle going on involving, let's say, orbital effects, then you might get much more modest fields to produce an effect on excitations.
Sorry, I don't quite follow the logic of these things, because a superconductor we know has a huge orbital effect anyway. So
yeah, that's right.
So also has these fermions, of course.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So what we're going to try to do is simply put a field on and see whether the resonance has an origin which is just simply to do with the underlying spin pairing, or has something to do also with the orbital motion of the fermions to do with the pairing. That's the question we're trying to answer. In other words, is a resonance just something? Is the wave function that you need for the resonance, is all that you need for it is simply to say that this is the energy that's required, let's say, to break up a singlet, or are you doing something else in addition? That's the question we're going to try to answer.
So you would also apply the field parallel to the AB plane.
Yeah, and so you're going to look for anisotropies and so on in the field. So this is the outcome of the experiment. So the outcome of the experiment is you put a field down. And mind you, so if they're going to be orbital effects of whatever origin, they're going to be very anisotropic in the field direction. And in fact, if we put the field along the c-axis for this 6 material, what's rather surprising is we put this very, very modest field on, something like 6.8 tesla, and you get a very dramatic suppression of the resonance. Okay, even though the resonance is a very, very large energy. Okay, and so if you had done this in a spin pile system, and if this had been simply the triplet mode in a spin pile system, you would have seen nothing out here at these kinds of fields.
So the peak doesn't shift very much?
No, the peak does not shift. The peak just simply stays put.
What's the temperature there?
Okay, so the temperature here is simply 10K. What we're doing is we're subtracting as background the 70K data. Okay. So we're just simply looking at the resonance, and we're seeing, as you know, the resonance grows as you enter the superconducting phase, and we simply first apply the field along the C-axis. This very, very modest field produces a very, very substantial effect on that signal.
When you subtract the 10K data or the 70K data from the 10K data, the 70K data in the lower panel also at 6.8 tesla?
Yeah, so this is everything is at 6.8 tesla here, everything is at 0 tesla.
Okay.
So we're just subtracting what we see at the low temperature, you know, high field, minus what we see at high temperature, high field, and this is low temperature. 0 field and high minus high temperature.
So a change in the data between 6.8 tesla and 0 tesla at 70 Kelvin?
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Let me just show you this first. The effect that we have is hugely anisotropic. So if I put the field in the AB plane, there's virtually no effect, or very, very little effect on this difference. Okay? And that's
some effect.
There's a small effect, but it's a much smaller effect than the other effect I showed you. It is outside of the air bar, and I'll show you a thing in more detail, which will show that further. Okay, so what this says is that is clearly that there is a strong orbital piece to this excitation. In other words, if it were only spin, remember that the magnetic penetration depth of this material is huge. And you're now in some kind of a flux lattice state, but the inhomogeneity is the field in the material is essentially homogeneous. And so if the only feature of this excitation were somehow something to do with spin pairing, then the effect would be isotropic in field. It is in fact highly anisotropic.
How much of this could be kind of effect
on the vortex form? Well, I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. This shows you what happens as a function of Q. This is just the same effect all over again. But let me just again say we have a very modest field with a very strong effect, a 30% effect at 34 millivolts with a field which is 6.5 tesla, which corresponds to just 7/10 of a millivolt or 7 Kelvin, much, much larger than TC, much, much less effect than the resolution. Actually, this is wrong. The resonance energy, which is around 360 Kelvin. The effect is anisotropic. It's much smaller for the field along the CO2 planes. And so what we conclude is that basically the resonance, this is the most direct evidence that the resonance is not some kind of a, just is not something that just measures pairing, just the density of pairs, but is in fact something that is sensitive to the overall phase coherence. Now, if you think about it superficially, which we do all the time, you could say, well, all this is basically an orbital effect, and the most natural orbital effect in a type 2 superconductor is from vortex inclusions. And so you could say, as a simple way to model what's going on, you say, well, the vortices are normal state inclusions. The superconducting state has this sharp resonance. The normal state has no sharp resonance. And the third thing you say is, oh, the resonance intensity then, if you believe all this, should just scale basically like 1 minus the volume fraction for the normal state inclusions, which goes like 1 minus B over BC2. But remember that although this sounds very deceptive, this line of reasoning is deceptively simple, it implies immediately that actually the resonance is actually measuring something more profound than just simply the density of pairs. It's actually measuring the number of it's measuring something that's sensitive to the long range phase coherence in the superconductor. Let's just check this simple volume exclusion principle. That volume exclusion principle, which by the way was assuming cylindrical cores, which we all know is incorrect, would give you a straight line basically going from basically a unity out to zero out of the characteristic field, in fact, which is something like 36 Tesla. Now, PC2 in this material is actually 45 Tesla. So, in fact, it is not a bad approximation.
The one piece of data you showed us is actually the piece of data that fell off.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I showed you some data that's on and some data
that seems like much bigger. These are like 15-20%.
These are 15 or 20%
of things. The data you showed just by eye looks more like 30%.
Look, I mean this is just the error bars. These are statistical error bars, and I'm not at all embarrassed by this. I mean this effect here. I mean, Patrick. I mean this happens to be another set where we scan as a function of Q, and you can see, you're getting a substantial effect here. It's really a matter this is another sweep. Again, you can see how large the effect is. I mean, here this effect is something like a, on the scale of the whole intensity variation is again a 20% effect or so. You're always getting roughly the same amplitude. So those. I don't actually even remember if actually. I actually chose to show you these. These are the highest fields. These are the 6.8 Tesla. Those are the ones I showed you initially. It depends where you normalize to.
Can we look at that data again?
Where we normalize to.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we're doing here is I'm showing you. This is 10K data.
No,
but the original data were difference plots.
Yeah, so
there were difference between 10. This is a difference between 10 and 70.
Yeah.
At 70, there's still a lot more intensity than you had at 150. It's how you normalize, to the base. This is a difference plot on this. Let me just show you. This is a difference plot here. This is 70 Kelvin. So if you take 70 Kelvin as a baseline, of course the effect is going to look bigger than if you take 150 Kelvin as a baseline. Because, this is a bigger number than that, and so you take a fraction and then you get a bigger effect. Right?
Oh,
the thing I showed you first was a difference, let me repeat, was
okay.
A difference, and I said that several times before.
Yeah.
It's a difference between 10 and 70.
Yeah.
70 is bigger than 150, so if I take the ratio,
But then, if you naively want to argue that your core is a normal state, then it's
now,
the first one that is the right thing to
it
do.
It is, in fact, the first one. However, I will tell you now why I don't believe that's the right thing, because, in fact, there is life above TC. And that's actually the most interesting thing. And that's what that brings me to this question.
Well, I agree with you. I just want to make sure
you've heard this talk before,
yeah.
So you know all the.
Okay.
You know the. This now shows you basically the question of, is there actually, do you see effects above TC or not? And our answer is, in fact, yes, you do. And what that means is that there is actually, even. Let's say at 70 Kelvin, you can see that it's not as clear as at 10 Kelvin, but there's definitely a suppression of the signal, of the resonance signal at 34 millivolts. If you go to 150 Kelvin, there is no noticeable effect when this peak is very, very broad, okay? Well, one thing that I need to point out is you notice these profiles really do broaden on going through TC, so this is a fairly narrow profile. 150 Kelvin, this is a fairly broad profile, so there's a very strong temperature effect on the correlation length. 62 Kelvin. Now, what about as a function of energy? And so now what I'm going to do is simply, now I'm going to take differences, not with temperature, but differences with field. We're going to take differences with a field of 0 Tesla, and we're going to subtract 6.8 Tesla. And what you see at 10 Kelvin is simply an image of the resonance. At 70 Kelvin, you see a blob. And it's the only thing you can say about this blob is it's a blob and that it's generally above zero. However, at 150 Kelvin, there's a blob there, but it's indistinguishable from zero. And so there seems it's as if, in fact, you took the resonance here and you smeared it out across something like 10 or 20 millivolts, on going from 10 to 70 k. However, again, if you look at the eyeball what you might think the integral is under this, it's actually rather similar to what you had at Kelvin.
What about all these points?
That's just what the differences are. I don't know.
Do we ascribe a line?
Excuse me?
Do we ascribe any significance?
I do not, but I certainly would not dare ascribe significance to outliers like that. What I do know, though, is that if I add up a lot of points like that, of course, the error bar in the total goes down. The other thing I do know is that this is not that. So that's all I'm... But
and it's not zero.
And this is not zero. Whereas this, I know, nobody in their right mind would say the integral under that is anything other than zero. The solid line is it's what's known as a fit. Okay. You don't need very many for that.
Yeah.
You just one is enough. You actually don't even need a Gaussian. You just need we actually decided we wanted to make sure that this is right, and so we changed the instrument configuration rather dramatically, just by changing the final neutron energy. But we get the same answer. There's basically at 7.5 Kelvin, you get the sharp resonance in the difference, and that resonance broadens out into something that's 20 millivolts wide at 70 Kelvin. Now, the next thing you might ask is, well, what about the anisotropy of the response? Do you see such a thing in this, even at 70 Kelvin? And the answer is maybe you do. At 10 Kelvin, this is actually the effect that Patrick noticed. There is a small effect, actually, with field on and field off. At this 72 Kelvin, it's rather more difficult.
What are you talking
about? I'm taking the difference field on, field off at two temperatures. Yeah, this is in the superconducting state, and this is just slightly above the superconducting, above 2C.
So the difference at one temperature.
The difference at a single temperature, field on minus field off.
Okay.
Okay. Actually, field off minus field on.
Very different differences.
Yeah, depending on what I wanted you to see. Whether I wanted to see a 30% effect or a 15% effect. In this case, I just want you to see that there's probably a small effect at 10 Kelvin, but not much of an effect at 72 Kelvin. So I think the outcome here is somehow that there is probably an orbital effect above TC. And that means, and of course, below TC, there's this effect that we can explain probably just in terms of saying that the superconductor has a resonance, the other thing does not have the resonance. But we seem actually to see things above TC as well. And one natural explanation for that is to invoke basically short-range superconducting phase coherence as well as spin pairing as its possible origin. So we really have the resonance now. I mean, until now, all of the stuff that we've had concerning the resonance have been these temperature-dependent curves and composition-dependent curves. And there was always a question about, you know, whether the resonance was measuring just something to do with the simple spin pairing, or also had something to do with the long-range phase coherence. And I think these measurements for the first time show that it has something to do with the long-range phase coherence, and it's not just simply coupled to the pseudo-gap formation. And the scenario then that we would say is that the integrated weight of the resonance, remember that the integrals under that fit, which you were wondering about, is roughly the same actually above or below TC. The integrate weight of the resonance may very well be probing the number of pairs. However, the width and frequency of the resonance, which we know we clearly see that it grows as you go above TC, may be something that you could relate to the phase coherence time. The width and k-space, which we see very dramatically evolving, may be something to do with the phase coherence length. And the t-dependence that we find, in fact, where we see the onset of temperature dependence. Let me just review for you what happened. Oops. Here, you'll notice that this open circles are field off and the closed circles are field on. And what you see is that this is where T star is. This is where the pseudo gap temperature is for this material. And what you see is, as you cool down, is that you really would never say there's any difference between field on and field off here. But you start to think to see that you probably see a difference up down in here. And that, in fact, is a conclusion that's very similar to the conclusion that's based, that Joe Ornstein reached based on optical data, that he was seeing first, basically, sort of pseudogap formation, which you cannot see, but followed by some short-range phase coherence, you know, which is, you know, signified by the fact that you do have a field effect turning on somewhat above TC, which would then occur at a somewhat lower temperature, which is still above TC itself.
That you would ascribe to just fluctuation
effect? Yeah. Okay, how much more?
Another question. Yeah. What is the conclusion based on? Because are you saying that the sharp resonance is seen only in the superconducting phase? Is that enough to explain most of your data?
The sharp resonance, what this is saying is that the resonance is there above TC. There's no.
Well, but it's not sharp.
I mean, it is there above TC. Yeah. However, it's field dependent. It is field dependent, also above TC, but it is field dependent. Yeah, but it is field dependent for a smaller range of temperatures above TC than the range of temperatures where you think you actually see the resonance. So the resonance, the onset of the resonance, is at a much higher temperature.
Yeah, but that has been known before.
Well, the onset of the resonance is here. And then what you're actually seeing is that the resonance actually acquires, the resonance is starting to see basically coherence effects in here, which you can then, you know, probe with the field. And you can then directly, what I'm telling you basically is that if the reactor ever comes up again, which is always an open question, you can start to actually measure, you can actually start to directly measure some kind of phase coherence times by measuring the width of these, by measuring the widths of these profiles. If you take better data than what we have now, what we have is simply the glimmer, not the reality, but the glimmer of a hope that we have a spectroscopy where the energy is actually well matched to the phase fluctuation times for this material.
Are you ascribing significance to the fact that the full and the dashed line don't meet till above TC?
I'm ascribing significance to the fact that these things.
I don't see any difference below TC.
There is at 70 Kelvin, we have a lot of evidence that there's an effect of the field, okay, which I showed you here. There's a lot of evidence that we have an effect of the field. And that evidence, this is the evidence. So at 70 Kelvin, all of these points are above zero, okay? All of these points are above zero. At 150 Kelvin, half of them are above zero and half are below. And what you need to do is, if you sum up all of these points, of course, then the point is that this is outside the error bars above.
That's in the fluctuating superconducting regime.
That is in the fluctuating regime of Ornstein.
Yeah. So we can just explain it as some kind of superconducting fluctuation.
You can explain it just as superconducting fluctuations, which we have now observed for you in this using the resonance. Yeah.
So I still understand where phase coherence comes in. You seem to ascribe something.
Well, the phase coherence. Yeah, so you have a phase coherence time for those superconducting fluctuations, which I would simply say, if we could measure this better and get a credible width out of that, which will simply be the inverse width of that. Okay?
I still don't understand the picture. Are you saying that between this and T star, 150 Kelvin, we do see a resonance, right? We've known that for a long time.
You see a resonance.
It's a resonance. Now, are you saying that is because we have a short range or the superconductor?
So the resonance, having a broad peak there comes about presumably because you have some kind of preformed pairs. Okay? Now then, that peak itself turns out to have a field dependence, which is seen here, which you
not about 70 Kelvin.
The only data I have in this detail is at 70 Kelvin. And so you can argue it is above TC, Okay, and you know, it's simply a matter then of saying whether you.
So,
you simply look 70 Kelvin. What we're saying is, we're just simply, all I'm saying is, you're around 70 Kelvin. This, we are quite convinced that there's an effect, and where the crossover temperature is up here, I do not know. All I can say is the data are suggestive. I simply would not want to claim to you.
Suggestive of what? Going to T star?
No, it's suggestive that it is not going to T star. The whole point I'm making is that the effect is weak, it is still there, but it is very, very weak at T star.
So again, there is
a crossover somewhere between TC and T star, which is probably closer to TC, where the space coherence effects start to show up, and this is very reminiscent of what Joe found in his optical data.
You know what, it doesn't nothing. Actually say that. I mean, it could just be merging down. You don't see, in your picture here, there's not an obvious T star star.
Right. There is not an obvious T star star because the statistics are not fantastic.
I understand. So that's what I'm saying. There may be a T star star there when you get the good statistics, but at this stage, it's not obvious whether it's.
There's just a gradual, no, but the point is it's simply a gradual onset of a field effect, but that onset is clearly, you see, look, there's very clearly a field effect here. There's very clearly a temperature effect here. It looks like the field effect turns on at a lower temperature than the original rise does, okay? So this is a big field effect, and that field effect dwindles into nothingness around here. It doesn't dwindle, it could have, had this stayed in simply fixed ratio to that, these points would have all been over here. Okay, that's all I'm saying, is you only start to see the field effect at lower temperatures, but you do have the important qualitative point is that there is a field effect above TC. Not that the precise temperature at which it occurs, but there is a field effect above TC.
What's so surprising about that? We know that it's strong superconducting
fluctuation. No, but it's connected. No, but the point is that it allows you, but there's nothing, there's no theorem that said that this X, that had to show up in the neutron, in this neutron spectrum. It did not have to show up in the two-spin correlation function, that field effect.
But this is consistent. What your point is basically, this is consistent with what Joe Einstein mentioned, right? So you basically have some range of phase fluctuations, which is 30 Kelvin above TC, and then there's some other effect which goes up to T star.
Yeah, that's all. But I mean, the point is that nobody predicted that there would be a field effect here. Nobody predicted actually below TC. And the point is that once you've seen this effect, before we did this measurement, the only thing we had were the temperature measurements, and you could not say whether the resonance had anything to do with the actual superconducting, with the coherent state, or was just simply something to do with preformed pairs and just came along for the ride. And I think these data clearly show you that. That to understand the resonance when you need to put in something to do with the actual phase coherence of the superconducting state. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but Gabe, it sounds like you're trying to tell us that we should take that on up a lot further than some of us would like to, in the sense that most of us, I think, would be happy to take that into the fluctuating superconducting regime of 10 degrees DC or something. But what you're saying makes it sound more like you believe, or that this data should be telling us, that there are pairs that are very important role somehow below T star, and that this is showing us that that's the case.
I don't think I'm saying anything nearly as strong as that. All I'm saying is that. People, we've been seeing this resonance for a long time, and some very simple pictures can be made of the resonance. You should say it's some kind of a single triplet excitation, or it's some kind of an interband transition, and I would find it very, very difficult to account for these kinds of field effects if that was all it was. Okay, if it was simply a sign of a singlet triplet excitation breaking up,
or it's a singlet basically breaking up into triplet, or if it was some kind of a simple interband transition. You know, both of those things would be Zeeman physics dominated. The physics here is not dominated by the Zeeman effect at all.
But then you would also have some kind of orbital current, right? I mean, you would have the Volovic effect, basically. And you don't know, I mean, if it's some kind of interband transition, you would have the Volovic effect, and you don't know how then the bands are basically shifted up and down.
Look, I'm just presenting this as a large, it's a large effect with a very modest field, which I think one would like to understand, you know, somewhat more quantitatively than I have done here for you today. That's all I'm asking here.
I think I actually agree with most of what you said. I just want to know what your picture is based on. So would you be happy with this picture that we have some kind of a two-fluid model, right?
Yeah.
Of this resonance. That right. In a normal state, there's right. already a relatively broad resonance.
Right, right.
And once you enter the superconducting state, a sharp resonance shows up in addition to this broad background.
Right.
And in the inside the core, you lose the sharp piece, but you still keep the far resonance.
Yeah. I
is
think
that what you would
I think that is was on this view graph, yeah.
Yeah. So that is happy. You're happy with that?
I'm happy with that.
Okay.
But I think then, you know, exactly.
So I am too.
The quantitative, but the quantitative, and that two-fluid thing is not, cannot easily be reconciled with some band picture, for example.
Yeah.
And I think this is important.
But I think we can say that without bringing in all kinds of coherence or.
Well, no, but then when you go above TC, then you start to ask, what is the interpretation of the width of that thing, and what is the interpretation of the integral under that thing? Well, then I would like to know what the meaning is of those numbers, right? And those are numbers that we can measure with larger accuracy if we, you know, if we knew there were some interest in them. But it's simply, at this point, it's an effect which we have this heuristic picture there with the disks, and of course, the picture you have in the high temperature state is the disks are starting simply to move around.
Right. But then, can I ask my first question again?
Yeah.
So if you buy this two-fluid picture, then when you try to compare with this vortex picture, then it is the other subtraction is the fair one to do. And then, can I say that basically your effect is a little bit bigger than...
Yeah, well, I mean, we have... Yeah, we've actually thought a little bit about that. I mean, there are two lines here through the data, and I don't know which... I just simply don't know what to do. One happens to be a square root, which you might think would be more sensible if the vortices have funny shapes. But I just say, I think this is going to be, there's going to be a lot more data on this. I mean, you can go to much larger, fields, among other things. I mean, we have magnets which go up to 14.5 Tesla. So having some predictions of what might happen here would be very, very welcome.
So at the moment, you haven't seen any field dependence of width, have you?
No. We actually have some hints of a small field effect.
But the Zeeman energy is very small.
The Zeeman energy is very small. Yeah.
Yeah. Less than.
This is a busy planet.
Yeah. But if you think the widths are to do with Zeeman effects and the other things, but let me just tell you, there's an oddity here. There's a seeming non-conservation of spectral weight when the field is varied at fixed temperature. And even though if you go to fixed field, the spectral weight is conserved. And, you know, we said, well, we lose the spectral weight, but I didn't tell you where did it go. And I should just say it's actually somewhat reminiscent of STM data, where if you go into the cores, all the main effect that happens in the cores is that you actually lose, you simply lose these coherence peaks at the edge of the, of the DIDV curve. Where, you know, basically, if you look at an STM spectrum of the core and the high-temperature superconductor, first, if it's just not, if there's no magnetic field present, then that's what you see. If you then, typically, if you put a field on, you simply lose these things here, and nobody really knows where that spectral weight goes. In this case, in this case, you see a similar effect. And let me just show you where our search is for this lost spectral weight. And lost spectral weight can go one of several places. It can go either to low energies, so you could be putting low energy signal in. You could also be moving the signal out to higher energies
or you could be moving it out in Q. And this shows you basically just rough attempts to try to retrieve some of the spectral weight. So if we go to lower energies below the gap temperatures, this is at 10 Kelvin at 16 millivolts transfer, it doesn't seem that there's much showing up there. If you go to 24 millivolts, which is where you see the incommensurate...
What are you plotting now?
Now I'm plotting as a function of Q. I'm just simply plotting fixed energy scans to go and see if I can find somewhere in Q space the signal that was lost. I'm going into
the circles are with field.
The circles are in zero field,
yeah.
And the closed things are in field.
And the
top one doesn't have zero field because we didn't have enough time. But the point is that it shows you if you had generated some kind of peak at pi pi or some incommensurate peak, what have you, you would have seen some rather more symmetric looking object in here, and the scales here are all the same. Is it 400, 500, 600? We just don't see very much. The point is, we just simply cannot see any credible magnetic signal showing up here at 16 millivolts. At 24 millivolts, we find this is well below the resonance, but is in the region that's just dominated by the incommensurate peaks. At 70 Kelvin, actually, there's actually a fairly substantial effect on the incommensurate peaks. In fact, they get pretty much whacked. A lot of the scattering around there gets whacked down by the field. At 10 Kelvin also, the field, if it has any effect at all, tends to reduce the incommensurate peaks. And so that means you're losing the intensity. I mean, you're losing the intensity in the commensurate peaks just as well as you're losing the intensity in the commensurate resonant peak. If you go above the resonance at 41 millivolts, if anything, there's a slight loss of signal at 70 K. Which is consistent, in fact, with the resonance being broadened at 70 K to include 41 millivolts. At 10 K, where the resonance now is very sharp and centered at 35 millivolts.
I didn't understand that. Because since if it was broadened, wouldn't you gain? Because you're above the resonant peak, so wouldn't you broaden it in?
No, wait a moment. I showed you that the resonance is broadened in energy, and I showed you a reduction at a large number of energies above TC. Okay, and so this is one of those energies where you see a slight reduction. There's a slight reduction, and that simply is because the resonance at that temperature is already broad, but you're just simply just crunching the whole thing down. Yeah.
Okay, can we come back to make sure I understand what you're saying? You're saying at fixed temperature, you're able to turn on a B field, and you lose some spectral weight. And can I make sure what that is? Imaginary chi of Q omega with this special factor, you integrate on omega and Q, and you get it. Is it plus one, or what is it?
No, there's nothing here. The only thing we're doing here is plotting raw data as a function of Q.
But I'm asking you, why do you think you're missing spectral weight? Why do you think it's conserved if you have a Hubbard model?
I'm not saying I think it's conserved. I'm saying it does not seem to be conserved in this case.
Okay. I guess all I put forth is you've told us that we should maybe think of this as a Hubbard model.
Yeah. In another part of
And with a Hubbard model,
there's no rule.
No conservation model.
Yeah.
And I believe that at least simple RPA-like models that we looked at won't conserve this stuff. When you start turning on a field and knocking the superconductor down.
Okay. I mean,
isn't that what you're doing?
I'm just simply doing an experiment to find out whether the spectral weight is being lost or not.
And what fields? Just say again.
This is 6.8 Tesla or 6.5 Tesla. These are the temperatures. So basically I'm checking for conservation. Basically I've checked it. We've checked it in some detail at 10 Kelvin and somewhat less at 70. And so look, let me just show this a bit more clearly in this next few graphs. Basically this is sort of the way the inelastic spectrum is located in EQ space, okay, for this stuff at 10 Kelvin. And what you see is there's a resonance at something like 35 millivolts, and then there are these incommensurate peaks that are emanating from it, which come down and are very clearly seen at 24 millivolts and terminate at the pseudo gap temperature. What we're finding is that in this area of phase space, a suppression. And we're not, everywhere we look in here so far, there's a suppression of intensity. There's not any buildup. However, if you go above here, there doesn't seem to be any effect of the magnetic field. Okay, so this is where there's a field effect, this is where there's no field effect. The direction of the field effect so far is only negative, crunching. Okay, we just simply have not been able to retrieve.
So, so this suggests that this incommensurate piece is also part of this stupid thing.
Apparently, yeah, apparently, because otherwise you wouldn't see this, you wouldn't see these effects. Okay, this is important. Okay, so that's, you know, so there's basically, so far, there's no luck in this hunt for increasing signals. We haven't found any increasing signals anywhere. There's a decreasing incommensurate signal, basically, for 24. Early voltage is less than resonance, but there's no decrease or increase above the resonance energy. And then, of course, one question then is somehow this resonance energy, the top of an excitation band, or it seems to be the top of an excitation band, which is sensitive to pairing. And this is not, you know, whereas above here is not the case. I mean, there's some already some clear hints of this reality, or not hint, but evidence for this was already seen in the original observation that we made of the incommensurate peaks, I guess 2 years ago, in the same material, where I'm showing you maps in Q space of the incommensurate peaks and the commensurate resonant peak. And what you see is that these things are very clearly defined at 13 Kelvin, and both of them are much less clearly defined above TC. So this is supporting the idea that the whatever coherence effects you have that come into defining the narrowness of this actually also come in there.
Okay.
Yeah?
Have you by any chance done some more magnetic field measurements in the LSCF?
By chance we have, but I'm not prepared to talk about them.
Okay, but certainly temperature does the same thing to the incommensurate peaks there.
Temperature does the same thing, and the incommensurate peaks there also, there's a very pronounced sharpening.
Yeah.
So, at TC. Yeah. So let me just conclude the talk then by saying, is a Heisenberg picture perhaps is some damping in disordered ground states. All we need to understand the spin sector in the high TC problem. And I believe the answer is really no. We revisited the insulator, and I think we have pretty good evidence that the best way to understand it, our data as well as Raman data, the various observations and the latter compounds, is that there are substantial ring exchange terms around, which are consistent with the ring exchange terms you find in the Hubbard model. The second thing is we've looked at the excitations in the superconductor, and we're basically probing with a magnetic field to see if there are orbital rather than just spin effects. And I think the conclusion is that the magnetic field effects that we see are primarily orbital. And again, that means that, you know, you're just simply not going to be able to think of these excitations in these systems as just in terms of little arrows that are localized at particular copper sites. But in fact, you have to think of these excitations as emanating from something which has other kinds of has basically some kind of orbital type phenomenon as well. And the most simple example of that would just be the superconductivity itself. But that aspect of the orbital aspect of superconductivity seems to enter in a very big way into those excitations, as well as the spin pairing aspect. Thank you very much.